There's an old saying, which I invented a couple of months ago, to the effect that there are only three kinds of people who say they have no anxiety about math. First, those who are extremely bright and see everything instantly. Secondly, those who are so neurotic that they can't experience fear. And thirdly, those who are liars. The purpose of the saying is that anxiety in the face of a problem, whether it be math or anything else, is a perfectly natural kind of experience. We all, with very few exceptions, have it in many areas, and certainly in mathematics. However, there are two ways of reacting to it. One is to realize that it's natural and say, I've got it, everybody's got it, so what, I'll go on and cope with the problem. But unfortunately, a lot of people react quite differently and freeze up when they see this problem confronting them, and then they are not able to cope with it. And this is what's now being called math anxiety. In the last couple of years, it's become a very fashionable topic. At almost any teacher's convention now, somebody is going to be lecturing on math anxiety. It doesn't mean they know anything about it, it just means that it's fashionable, so somebody always wants to talk about it. I got interested in it last springtime and trying to figure out why it was that so many folks have math anxiety. As a math teacher, I've heard conservatively hundreds and probably thousands of people say, gee, I did good in school except for mathematics. They never say, I did good in school except for history or except for English. It's always mathematics, it seems, that causes the trouble. Very common remark. So I spent a lot of time last summer just thinking through my own experience as a teacher and wondering why this was happening. I also wondered about my own credentials to deal with the matter. My credentials are that I've been a math teacher for about 25 years, junior high, senior high, college, graduate level. My master's degree is in mathematics. My PhD is in educational technology, which is just a fancy word for high-level problem solving or high-class problem solving. I've written three textbooks on mathematics, the new math back in the late 50s and early 60s. And because of the books, I had to do a lot of serious thinking about elementary math. I don't really know much math. I stopped at the master's degree, which is just where math begins to get interesting. But I've had a lot of experience in teaching it. Well, I don't know if those are the right credentials for trying to investigate math anxiety or not. Perhaps nobody knows, so I figured, why not me? So I'm really interested in it and expect to do some work in it in the future. In thinking over the articles I had read and my own experience, it seemed to me that there are at least four causes for math anxiety that I can already see, even though I've not been involved in the field for very long. First, cultural stereotypes. Secondly, personal episodes or experiences. Thirdly, the lack of a basic skill in problem solving. And fourth, some factors that are intrinsic to mathematics, or at least the way math is usually taught. So what I'm going to do today and tomorrow is to deal rather briefly with the first three, and then spend at least half of the time talking about things that are intrinsic to math that cause difficulties and, I think, lead to anxieties. There's also one practical exercise I want to do, either at the end of this morning's session or perhaps tomorrow morning. The reason that cultural stereotypes have been pointed out as an important cause for anxiety is historical, namely that the first articles written on the subject were written by women educators who were interested in women's liberation and women's education. For example, one of the most striking articles concerned the University of California. An assistant dean of something or other found that there are 20 programs of study at the University of California. In order to enter those programs, in 15 of the 20 cases, you have to have 4 years of high school math. So if you don't have 4 years of high school math, you can only take 5 of the 20 programs of study. She then found that something like 57% of the male students entering the University of California had had 4 years of high school math, and only 8% of the women had had 4 years of high school math. Now that's really a kind of a staggering statistic. That meant that 92% of the female students at the University of California could only go into those five areas of study: nursing, humanities, social service, music, that kind of thing. So just think what that means in terms of their employment in the future. They're being channeled into just 5 of 20 programs of study because they didn't have 4 years of high school math. Well, that's the fact of the matter, but then the question is, why is it that only 8% of the female students have 4 years of high school math? Well, surely one of the reasons is the cultural stereotypes that most of us grew up with. Little girls are made of sugar and spice and not mathematics, right? We were all taught that. At least those of us who were on the far side of 30 were taught that. A good example is a friend of mine in Washington. She was the younger of 2 children. Her older brother was very good in math and science, and she was told in no uncertain terms by her parents that they expected her to be good in English and art and things like that. So she's ended up a photographer, a very good photographer. She's quite bright, quite capable of doing science and math, but she knows that she's had to struggle all her life with this image that her parents forced on her. Well, that's a very explicit kind of expectation on the part of her parents. It's all too common that parents are not quite that explicit, but the effect is the same. Little girls are not supposed to be good at math. It's possible to exaggerate that point because there are many little boys who are also told that they're not supposed to be good at math. As you know, there's a long stream of anti-intellectualism in this country that goes back to frontier days and hasn't disappeared yet. So many boys are also told that, well, yeah, math is too hard. You'll never get it. Don't worry about it. But it does seem to show up more for females than for males. And it's a very hard thing to deal with. Once a child's personality is molded that way, it's not something you can undo easily. I read a long time ago in a psychology book that success will change you. You know, if you have success in some endeavor, then that reinforces you and you start, you know, going at it like crazy. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. I've had the experience endless numbers of times of having a student in class who's got trouble on some particular point and he's just totally frustrated. I can't get it. I can't do it. And so I take him aside and explain it slowly and clearly and do a problem. And then I have him do a problem. He looks up and he says, oh, that's easy. You know, and I say, right, it's easy. And he feels good for about 30 seconds. But then when he hits the next topic, same problem all over again. So that kind of cultural conditioning is not easy to deal with. And a few simple successes in the problem area doesn't take it away, unfortunately. What kind of changes can we expect in the future? Well, you all know as much as I do about what's happening to our society. The movement for women's liberation is bound to have effects of one kind or another on the way children are brought up, primarily for the good, I think. And one of the side effects is going to be, I'm sure, an increased enrollment by female students in high school in math courses. I have a 5-year-old girlfriend in Washington who lives down the street who is starting boxing lessons next month. Her grandmother is aghast that her granddaughter is going to take boxing, but I think it's marvelous. Her older brother is taking boxing, so she wants to. Why not? She's not going to get hurt. So I suspect our culture is going to change, but not as fast as we would like. The other side of the coin is what happens to those who are no longer children and already have math anxiety. What kind of therapy is there for them? I don't know the answer to that, unfortunately. There are some people around the country who are now giving workshops whose purpose is to deal with math anxiety, but there's no scientific data yet as to whether they're effective or not. I may get into that business myself. I have a friend who's getting his PhD in psychology from the University of Texas. And he has suggested that we start our own business next year when he's finished his dissertation. So we are going to try to work up some workshops or clinics or something of that sort to see what we can do for people who already have math anxiety. But at this point, I can't predict whether or not we will be successful. A second cause of math anxiety is the personal experiences of people. Many people, especially those who are more sensitive and more intelligent, can look back at their life and point to specific episodes which was the start of their math anxiety. The literature is just filled with case histories like this. And I've met a number of people myself who were very clear about just exactly when their math anxiety started. For instance, there's a biology teacher at my school named Emma, very good teacher, very bright woman. When she was in the seventh grade, they all took a placement test to see who would go into the accelerated math program in the eighth grade. The principal established 75, a score of 75 is the cutoff point. She scored 74, all right? Well, the principal said, Emma, you're a good student and everything. I want you to go into this program anyway. So she was put into the accelerated program. First day of class in the eighth grade, the teacher called her aside and said, Emma, you only got a 74. You're not going to make it. I know you'll never do it. But the principal insists that you be in here so you can stay. But don't bother me. Don't bug me. And she got this attitude all year long from this eighth grade teacher. Well, she wasn't old enough to have enough self-confidence to overcome this force from the teacher. And so she just, you know, got all frizzled and frazzled about mathematics. She was smart enough to become a good science teacher, but to this day, she can't really handle math. It just freaks her out. And she knows exactly why. Another example, last winter, I went out to dinner, and among the guests was a woman lawyer who worked at the White House, and she had a similar experience. She had grown up in Southern California, and at that time, the school system was segregated three ways, not just two ways, as I'm used to in Washington. The white Anglo students went to one school, the Chicanos went to a second school, and the blacks went to a third. And the Indians were dumped into one of those three. I've forgotten which one. Then a court order came along saying they had to integrate. So all the Chicano children were put in with the Anglo children. Well, this woman at that point was a sixth grader, and she was bilingual and very bright, but her Anglo teacher didn't speak a word of Spanish. So the teacher drafted her as a translator. And so she spent the entire sixth grade being a teacher's assistant and translating for the Chicano children. Well, the result was that she didn't learn any math at all in sixth grade. And then when she got to seventh grade, she found that because she had missed that whole year, nothing made any sense to her. So here she is now, a successful woman in her 30s, has a couple of children. She's been a judge in California. She was a lawyer in the White House. Now she's got some other great job. She can barely cope with her checkbook as a result of this experience. She is never going to do anything in math unless she gets some kind of therapy for it. Well, those are just two typical cases. In most cases, it seems to be the teacher who is the villain in the story. That for some reason, a lot of teachers seem to put students down and so shake them up that they just can't cope with the subject anymore. It would be nice to say that, well, that's going to change in the future, but I'm pretty doubtful that it will. Unfortunately, American teachers, especially grade school and high school teachers, are very poorly educated. In the 60s, I traveled around the country a good deal lecturing at math teachers' conventions. And my impressions from those contacts were bolstered by various surveys taken by professional organizations. And I was astonished, for example, to discover that something like maybe two-thirds or three-fourths of American high school math teachers have never had any math beyond high school, with maybe one semester of calculus. So they're teaching up to the level of their knowledge. Teachers of that sort would not be allowed to set foot in a classroom in Europe. If you teach in a lycée or a gymnasium, you have to be very well educated in your subject matter. More or less the equivalent, say, of having a master's degree in your subject, and you teach only that one subject. So I think that a lot of this putting down of students comes from the fact that teachers don't know what they're talking about a lot of the time, and this makes them very defensive. A student who asks a good question is told to shut up because the teacher doesn't know the answer, right? Doesn't want to deal with it. Unfortunately, I don't think that very much is going to happen there in the near future, at least. Perhaps the tight job market will have some impact, force out some of the poorer teachers, possibly. But I don't see very many changes on the near horizon. It would be nice if people who had had these personal experiences could find a form of therapy, and various things are being tried. For example, there are two math teachers in New York who have started a business called Mind Over Math, and they give workshops. In fact, I'm told they're so successful they're about to quit their teaching jobs and be full-time on it. A number of schools, perhaps a dozen or two dozen, are trying different forms of therapy, and they tend to fall into two categories. In some places, the counseling department will set up a workshop which doesn't attempt to teach any math. They have a kind of sensitivity session in which everybody talks about their math anxiety, and yes, I remember when I was seventh grade and Mr. So-and-so really zapped me. Whether it works or not, nobody knows. It's too experimental to say. Other places are trying to... were you raising your hand, Mary Schramm?
Yeah, when
you're done.
Pardon? Well, I just had a question.
Yeah.
Do you think, I mean, this shows my very bad attitude toward math, but I seem to have the feeling that people that can grasp math, like people that want to teach it, have a certain kind of mindset that enables them to see concepts and thump like that, but that they don't necessarily have the personality or the ability to deal with people, which therefore makes them very poor teachers. I mean, I can't remember a good mm-hmm. math teacher that I ever had. They were very bright, but not, they couldn't teach like history or English
mm-hmm.
teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And is that just the really stereotype that I put on them just because I have tremendous math anxiety? You think that could be true?
It could be true. You do get, I think, more of certain personality types in certain fields. For instance, clergy are noted as being obsessive compulsives, right? You find far more obsessive compulsives among clergy than almost any other category. Right, exactly. You think you got troubles. It's been a struggle, I'll tell you. And I think the same kind of thing is true of scientists and mathematicians. That you do tend to get more rigid personality types in that area.
I think I could add another dimension to that, anxiety reasons. I didn't start teaching until I was a grandmother many times over. And if you were responsible for introducing that new math, I don't know that I like
it. Anyway, partly.
I did get with it, and I had to teach the new math. My biggest problem was with the parents.
Mm-hmm.
You try to teach the, you know, start from scratch and teach the child this new concept, new technique, and then the parents come for counseling. Mrs. Reedy, I just don't understand one thing. I can't help the child. Mm-hmm. And they instill in this child, mm-hmm. you know, this is all bosh, and I can't handle it, so I don't know that you'll ever do it, you know, because
right.
I can't do it.
Exactly.
And I think I'd spend half of counseling time getting up at the blackboard and teaching the parents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And explaining the concepts to them.
That was part of it.
And as I say, there is another dimension
mm-hmm.
for your anxiety, that the parents, not only the teacher,
mm-hmm.
but the parents instill this in
mm-hmm.
the child.
Another problem with the new math was a lot of the teachers who had to teach it didn't understand it.
Ooh,
and
yes.
Some of the textbook authors who wrote the new books didn't understand it either.
And then the thing that got to me was that after all was said and done, and you taught these new techniques, we always went back to the old method eventually. You had to learn that anyway. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So why didn't we start there in the first place and do it like we used to do it? Eventually, that's how it ended up. You had to do it the old way. I mean,
mm-hmm. That's now changing, too. With the advent of pocket calculators, that's going to have a big impact on the way you do things.
I always thought they were a threat to me.
Mm-hmm.
The kids really says, you're not going to learn multiplication tables, you know, and quick answers to things by punching that thing. But now you have to get into that.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't dream of doing a long division by hand anymore. I mean, I got more important things in life to do than long division when the calculator will do it for me. Some people are trying to deal with these anxieties by teaching a special section of a math course in which they spend part of the time dealing with anxiety and part of the time teaching math. Well, I don't know. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. It's really all too new at this point to make any predictions. Another cause that underlies, I think, at least some people's math anxiety is the lack of a very basic skill in dealing with problems of any sort, and not just math, but any sort of problems. The reason I've gotten very interested in this side of it is that my friend who's doing his dissertation on math anxiety gave me a fascinating book called Cognitive-Behavioral Psychology by Donald Meichenbaum. When I first became acquainted with behavioral psychology, I had very mixed feelings with it. You know, B.F. Skinner and all those folks. They put so much stress on exterior behavior and pay no attention to what goes on inside people that I found that very unrealistic. And I don't like the idea of giving people M&Ms for doing a problem right, which is, you know, sort of the typical Skinnerian reinforcement. But I've discovered that in the last 5 or 10 years, a number of behavioral psychologists have shifted their emphasis very markedly and now do focus a lot on people's minds, what goes on inside, as well as their external behavior. And so they label themselves cognitive-behavioral psychologists. In their investigations, they have focused on a very interesting aspect of how people learn that I had never thought about very explicitly. And they describe it with the term self-talk. The simplest way to think of it is, imagine somebody learning how to drive a car, and so somebody else explains to him what the various pedals and levers are and what you do and in what sequence you do it, and they demonstrate it, and then the person gets in the driver's seat, and it's not at all unusual to hear the person talking to himself out loud, right? First I put my left foot down, then I shove up with my right hand, then I put my right hand down. It's a perfectly natural thing to sort of rehearse out loud the instructions you've gotten. So you're talking to yourself. Now, if you follow that aspect of it through, what happens is that after you've done this a bit, you start abbreviating your sentences. Initially, you speak in whole sentences. You say, now I put my left foot down. Well, after a while, you abbreviate and you say, left foot, right hand, right foot. It's abbreviated to phrases. Then after a little while longer, you don't say it out loud, but you're still saying it inside. You know, nobody else can hear it, but you're still talking to yourself. And as you develop the skill, and as it becomes more and more habitual, the self-talk inside, this internal conversation, not only gets abbreviated, it kind of sinks down in your brain and gets less and less audible to you, and finally just sort of stops. It gets to a point where you don't say it anymore. In other words, the skill becomes so automatic that you don't have to talk, and so the talk kind of disappears in the bottom of your brain someplace. And it's not only in manual skills where this happens. It happens at all levels with all kinds of things. But a month ago, a student stopped at my desk at school. He couldn't find his calculus teacher, so he asked for some help in solving a problem. Well, I hadn't taught calculus in several years, and you do get a little rusty. And so I noticed that when I helped him with his problem, I started doing this self-talk all over again. And that was a little unusual, because when I teach algebra, I've taught that so many times and so recently that I don't have any self-talk. I do everything almost automatically. If you hand me a piece of paper with a linear function and say, what's its slope? My brain doesn't work. I mean, the top part, it's just like automatic writing. I pick up a pencil, no, there it is. Because I've done it so much and it's so habitual. But when he gave me this calculus problem, I had to recite to myself, the downstairs times the derivative of the upstairs minus the upstairs times the derivative of the downstairs over the downstairs squared. I said this to myself because I had the formula memorized, but I had to recite it to make sure I did it right because I was a little bit rusty. So this business of self-talk occurs in all areas, not just in manual things. It's a fascinating idea. It has all sorts of implications that I'm still trying to explore. For instance, it says something to me about why it's so much easier to relearn something than to learn it. Psychologists say that if you learn something well in the first place and then move away from it and just don't do it for a while and come back and have to relearn it, it'll take you maybe one-third as much time. It's much, much faster. And I think the reason is that the self-talk has sort of floated down into the bottom of your brain and is sort of sitting there out of sight, and when you go to relearn, it's not as though you have to go outside and pull all this new information and stuff into your head. It's already there. What you have to do is sort of lift it up a few floors to the point where it's conscious again, and you can recite these things to yourself. I think it also explains why people who have no experience at teaching often have a lot of trouble explaining to somebody else. I've had this kind of experience. I see somebody doing something neat that I've never done before, maybe welding or something like that, and so I walk up and say, gee, you're really good at that. How do you do it? And the person will say, how do you do it? Well, you know, you pick up this and push it here and this, and that's how you do it. It's all there, see? And you say, gee, thanks a lot. You didn't learn a thing. Because he was so automatic in the way he did it, he couldn't explain it to you. And the problem is that his learning process had gotten to the point where the self-talk had sunk down to the bottom of the brain, and he'd never had occasion to bring it up again. And that's what teachers do all the time. You're constantly bringing up into the top of your mind this kind of self-talk, and that's what you give to somebody else. You ask me how to solve an equation. Well, I've got this self-talk already because I'm a teacher. So there are lots of fascinating aspects to this. These psychologists who are working on this concept of self-talk have used it in dealing with a whole bunch of different kinds of clients, schizophrenics, impulsive children, you know, the kind who are hyperactive and they often put drugs into. And they've had a lot of success in exploiting this idea of self-talk. When they listen to the children, for instance, who were hyperactive, attempting to do a task, one of the first things they noted was that the self-talk was very inappropriate. It had nothing to do with the task and betrayed the fact that the child didn't know what he was supposed to do or got hung up on some other aspect of it. You've probably done the same kind of thing yourself. Somebody has a problem and if they can't get it, after about 2 minutes you hear them muttering, "Dumb problem, I can't do this dumb problem." And it's the problem that's dumb that gets to be the focus of attention. And schizophrenics will often get hung up on something. Maybe the task is to put the blue jar in the yellow one and then put them both in the green one. So they pick up blue jar in the blue jar, blue jar, blue jar, and sit there for 5 minutes saying blue jar to themselves instead of talking to themselves about the task itself. So they got the idea, maybe if we taught these folks the right kind of self-talk, they'd be more successful in doing the task. And so they invented or modified some earlier techniques and developed something they call cognitive modeling. The psychologist will sit down with a child, for instance, and they'll have a little task to do. And the psychologist will not only do the task, he'll talk out loud as he does it, making explicit to in the hearing of the child all of the good things you ought to be saying to yourself as you're doing this task. And he'll do this several times, and then he'll have the child do the task, and he'll say to the child, "Now you talk out loud just the way I did." Not trying to memorize the psychologist's words, but to say the same kinds of things. And so the child then imitates the psychologist and talks out loud about the task in the same way. And when he's done it a few times successfully, then the psychologist will say, "Okay, this time whisper these words to yourself." And so the child practices some more whispering the self-talk. And when that's going on long enough, the psychologist will say, "Now this time say it so quietly that I can't hear it." So in other words, the self-talk begins to fade and becomes internalized, and then finally the child keeps on doing it without any external talk, but saying it internally, and then by that time has mastered the task. And it's worked very well with impulsive kids, with schizophrenics, and lots of other types. I found it a very interesting thing to read about because it made me suddenly a little uptight. What have I been doing as a teacher all my life? And as I thought about it, I realized that in some cases I do cognitive modeling without deliberately doing it. For instance, whenever a student asks me a question that's sort of off the wall, something I never thought about before, for some reason I have always instinctively modeled cognitive behavior of the right sort. I guess because I've had an instinctive wish that students tune in to the right way you think mathematics. In other words, if you're doing a little bit of research of the most minimal sort, it's really good for kids to see the way the mind should go about it. So I've always done it there. In ordinary teaching, I do it sometimes and not other times. So I hope in the future to spend some more time thinking about this as a possible form of therapy to teach people who don't have the basic skills of problem solving what kind of cognitive behavior should be going on. Because it's all pretty much the same regardless of whether it's math or something else. You start off by being clear about what the problem is, and then you develop a little plan for dealing with it, and you have to monitor your progress as you're working through the solution. You have to admit to yourself that everybody makes errors, and it's okay, and you can cope with it. There are ways of retrieving your mistakes. You have to evaluate the final result. You ought to pat yourself on the back and say, "I did it, good for me." And you do the same thing basically with any kind of problem. There are a lot of folks, however, who can't solve problems because they don't have this sequence somehow in their repertoire of behavior. So if you can teach them the basic skill of problem solving, I think that provides a kind of platform for learning mathematics. It's not a substitute. You still have to take an algebra course and a trig course and so forth and so on. But if you lack that platform, I think you're really in trouble and are liable to be very frustrated. I'm going to go now into one example from the fourth type of cause, namely things that are in mathematics itself, which I think are responsible for a lot of anxiety. And then tomorrow I'll develop the other examples that I've got. The first one has to do with an old friend of yours and mine called common denominators. You all remember common denominators, right? I haven't had enough experience yet in interviewing people to know what percentage of anxiety is due to common denominators, but I'm sure it's substantial. A lot of folks have trouble. A typical question, is this the time when I use a common denominator? Do I have to use a common denominator here? I hear this especially from older students who have come back to our college to take refresher courses. You know, they had it years ago before they got married. Now they're getting back into the job market. And they're trying to remember, is this the place I use a common denominator? And the way they ask the question betrays the situation they're in, namely that they're trying to remember. They have always relied on their memorization abilities, and that's one of the worst things you can do in mathematics. The other day, a buddy of mine at school who has his PhD in math said about himself the same thing I've always known about myself. The reason he went into math is because you don't have to memorize very much. It's so easy compared to most sciences and arts. Very little to memorize in math. If you really understand what's going on, that means you don't have to memorize much of anything. So to the extent that you can get underneath concepts and really get hold of them and see them with crystal clarity, then there's not much to memorize, which is great because I have a poor memory. Now the reason I think that people have trouble with common denominators is because they never really understood them in the first place. And it all goes back, I think, to addition. Very simple idea of what addition is all about. And basically, what addition is all about is that you've got a pile of 3 apples over here and 4 apples over here, and you push them into a big pile and you count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 apples. And that's all there is to addition. Now, people try to make it more complicated than it is. But essentially, that's all there is to addition, pushing 2 piles together and counting the big pile. Even when you get to things that are moderately abstract, like finite dimensional vector spaces or something, where you have addition of vectors, still you're doing basically the same thing. You may have several piles instead of just 2 piles, but you're
Stop
just pushing piles together.
Excuse me? Stop and tell us what is a vector.
Oh, it's too complicated to go into. But if you ever get there, all you're doing with addition is pushing piles together. So look out for it. It's very easy if you ever try to add vectors. Now, there is one little problem, though, connected with addition. The basic idea of pushing 2 little piles into a big pile and then counting is very simple. There's one problem, though. If I have 3 apples over here and 4 oranges over here and I push them into a big pile and I count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, what have I got? I've got 7. What? That's where the problem is. It's hard to answer the question. Now, if you're really sneaky, you can say you've got 7 pieces of fruit, and that's a clever answer. But it doesn't really solve the problem. Now, the problem is that I started with 3 apples and 4 oranges instead of 3 apples and 4 apples. So let's think for a minute about the name apple and orange. It's really a kind of unit of measure, to like inches and feet and ounces and pounds and so on. So when you have these piles, you usually attach a label, a unit of some kind to them. And in this case, we're talking about something very specific, apples and oranges. Now, when you push them together into one pile and try to name it, you have a problem. You can't use the same specific unit. You can't call it 7 apples. You can't call it 7 oranges. If you call it 7 pieces of fruit, that's clever, but notice what you've done. You've dropped the specific units and gone to a generic unit, right? Generic just means a higher level of generality. It includes more things. Now, that's useful sometimes, but it doesn't really solve the problem. So the problem is then that if you're trying to add a pile which is described by one specific unit and another pile that's got a different specific unit and you push them into one big pile, what unit do you use to describe it? That's the problem. If both of the piles have the same specific unit, like the original example, 3 apples and 4 apples, then there's no problem. It's when you have 2 different specific units that you've got a problem. Now, unfortunately, in the real world, it's usually not very helpful to go to a generic unit to talk about pieces of fruit. Sometimes it is. Sometimes that'll solve the problem of saying what you've got in the big pile, but often it isn't. If I ask you how much change have you got in your pocket, and you reach in and figure out you've got 3 half dollars and 4 quarters, and you tell me you've got 7 coins, that's not very helpful. I still don't know how much money you've got. And that's sort of typical. Generic units are often not very communicative. They don't carry enough information. So there is still a problem. How do you deal with these specific units? Now, I think the difficulty with fractions is, or can be solved, by thinking in terms of this idea of specific units versus generic units. When you see a fraction, I think it's very helpful to think of it in terms of so many specific units. For instance, if you have 3 over 2, instead of looking at it as a single entity, think of it as the way you read it, 3 halves. Halves is like apples. Think of the halves as a specific unit. And if you've got 4 fifths, think of the fifths as a specific unit, like oranges, a specific entity here. So you've got 3 of one kind of thing and 4 of another kind of thing. 3 halves, 4 fifths. Psychologically, it's much easier to deal with fractions if you think of them in those terms. All right, then suppose you've got your typical addition problem. You've got your 3 halves, like 3 apples, and 4 fifths, like 4 oranges, and you push them together into one big pile, and you count them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 7 what? Now, I know what you're going to say. You're going to say 7 fractions, right? And that's a good answer as far as it goes, but in order to say that, you have to leave behind the specific units and go to a generic unit again, which is not very helpful. So we're back to the same problem. If you have 2 different specific units, like apples and oranges, or halves and fifths, and you put them all in a big pile, how do you count the big pile? Well, the counting is all right, but how do you put a unit on it? That's the hard part. Well, there are some techniques that help you do what enables you to solve the problem. The purpose of the techniques is to take these fractions, 3 halves and 4 fifths, and to replace both of the fractions by another pair of fractions that has the same specific unit. You can't really do that with apples and oranges, right? You can't turn an orange into an apple. But you can take fractions and replace them by another fraction that's equal to it. You know, a half is equal to 2/4, which is the same as 4/8, and so on. There are lots of equal fractions. So you can take your 3 halves and 4 fifths and replace them by 2 fractions that have the same specific units. There are techniques for doing that I'm not interested in, but you know, they're not difficult to learn once you've got the basic idea. These techniques tell you that 3 halves can be replaced by 15 tenths, and the 4 fifths can be replaced by 8 tenths. And now I've got the same specific unit, 15 tenths and 8 tenths is like 15 bananas and 8 bananas. Now I can push them all into the big pile and count them and come up with 23 bananas, or 23 tenths. Now there are 2 aspects to this. First of all, the most important thing is the basic idea. What do you do when you add? You just shove things together. But you're going to run into a problem of how do you name the answer unless you've got the same specific units in the 2 little piles. So there are some, and this is the second aspect, there are some very specific techniques for manufacturing these new fractions. And if you know what you're looking for, they're very simple to learn, and I'm not going to talk about those at all. So with these techniques, you can manufacture fractions that do have the same specific unit. Once you've got that, it's like adding 3 apples and 4 apples, and you push them together and you get 7 apples. What could be easier? And that's all there is, absolutely all there is to common denominators. It's just solving the problem of apples and oranges.
How do you make the leap from apples and oranges to fractions, to changing the apples into oranges or the oranges into apples so that you can add them together?
Well, and there are 2 leaps, Jack, and I'm not sure which one you're talking about. The idea of looking at fractions as having 2 parts, a number and a unit, 3 halves, as opposed to one number. That's one leap, and I don't know, I just do it automatically. It's a psychological way of dealing with mathematics. It's not the formal way. Who needs formality at this point? The other leap is the techniques.
Of turning them all into bananas. I mean, that's right. Magic.
Well, no, that's very simple to do. If you understand the first thing about that you got to have apples and apples and not apples and oranges, and therefore your search is for bananas, once you've got that part, the rest is easy. It's just a mechanical technique. I could teach it to you in 2 minutes without any trouble.
Mm-hmm. No, I understand what it is. I teach 6th grade math.
Oh, okay. You got it then.
Well, I've got the problem of that.
Probably the best way is to...
Fractions and common denominator.
Mm-hmm.
Believe that apples and bananas do not have a common denominator except fruit. But 2/3 and 4/5 do have.
You can find a specific unit that'll deal with them both. It's an improvement over the world of fruit. So it's the specific techniques that are causing the problem. How do you manufacture the new fractions? Is that where the trouble is?
No, how to illustrate. It's easy to say to a kid, okay, here's three apples, four apples, mm-hmm. three apples.
Mm-hmm.
I've got seven apples. But now I have three of these things and four of these things. How many things do I have? One, two, three. You have seven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you were saying.
Maybe there's another concrete object other than apples and bananas that you could come up with that would be a parallel between the numbers. I can't think of one, but...
Yeah, that's what I'm searching for.
Most teachers that I know that have had success in teaching fractions to children, and what I'm talking about really is more aimed at adults rather than kids, have used the basic techniques like cutting up a watermelon, or have you three or four pies around, and you can cut up and say that half a pie here, and then you cut this one into quarters, and you can say, well, the two quarters fit right on top of the half, so they're really the same, aren't they? You know, and money, everybody understands money. It's amazing. It's the best image possible for dealing with mathematics. And gambling, well, that's for other areas of mathematics. Yes?
Have you ever tried to teach mathematics simply on the abstract level and not get bogged down in these tangible examples?
No, and I'm not sure it's a good idea, except maybe in graduate school. At least for kids, for grade school, junior high, and senior high, most people really need some concrete experiences, if at all possible, as a basis for the abstractions that they're going to form. I mean, there's a teacher whose name I can't remember, Hungarian fellow, who has taken topics like group theory, which I'll speak about later on, which used to be mentioned only for the first time in graduate school, and he's teaching it to second graders because he takes concrete examples. And once you have enough concrete experience, then you can gradually begin to abstract from it. But I'd be leery of getting too formal too early. I mean, a mind that thinks abstractly can cope with it, but most people don't.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I love formalism. It's just fun. It's like learning a chess game, just arbitrary definitions. A zilch is three numbers in a row, and to add two zilches, you stand them upside down and divide by 89. You know, I love things like that. That's fun for me, because I think that way, but most people have trouble learning in a formalistic manner.
But it seemed to me that, well, you said there are lots of examples of half. There are lots of equivalents for a half or a 16. That's completely abstract, but that's what you need. That's what you need to find the common denominator, and that's all you really need.
Well, is it really that abstract if I can cut up a pie?
I used to get so confused by the examples.
Oh, you get confused by
the
examples.
I always try to take the example to its furthest.
Mm-hmm.
Dimension, and then they always break down.
How do you get a 19th of a pie? That's hard. I guess what you're saying is that some people had better stop doing examples more quickly than other people.
Mm-hmm. I was fine with math until algebra, which is completely abstract.
Yeah, different people need different amounts of examples, but by and large, I think the more imagination you put into it, the better. One of the things I'm going to talk about later on is the fact that imagination has a big role to play in math, and it's underemphasized. That if you can really visualize situations, you've got half the solution right there.
Why are
kind
fractions?
Of a paradox.
Why are fractions the problem?
And
it carries over forever and ever and ever.
They are
less than one. How can you have something less than one?
What it is?
One of the things I'll get into later on is the fact that a lot of things change as soon as you switch from whole numbers to fractions. A lot of things change, like littler than one. When you multiply them together, the answer is smaller. How can the answer be smaller when you multiply? You know, the answer is supposed to be bigger when you multiply. But it isn't a fraction.
Even just adding the fractions, it seems that if a person could add two and two, and when you ask them to add a half and a half, that there must be some common denominators that carry over.
Well, there are.
There are problems.
There are problems because of this difference of specific units. You don't get that with whole numbers. If you just deal with abstract whole numbers, threes and fives, well, with no units attached, it's very easy to memorize the answers and spout them out again, or to visualize three apples and five apples and you get eight apples. But as soon as you get to fractions where you get two numbers, you got to deal with both of them. which am I adding, the top number or the bottom number?
Yeah, right.
And you get a whole bunch of special rules for doing special things, and they all get mixed up and mashed up, and people end up saying, is this where I use a common denominator? Because there's so many conflicting rules. Some you use now, some you don't use in that situation. Well, the nice thing about common denominators, once you understand it, there's only one time in your whole life you'll ever use common denominators, and that's when you're pushing two little piles together. Multiplication, forget it. Division, forget it. Square roots, powers, forget it. The only time you have to fuss with common denominators is when you're pushing two little piles together. Or pulling them apart. But everything I've said about addition can be translated into something about subtraction, too.
But all these kind of rules. Well, when you said, you know, you need an imagination, that's kind of a paradox. Because you always think people that are good at math as being concrete, very specific, everything is, you know, laid out. And the idea of having imagination come into that is really sort of intriguing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to talk about that considerably more tomorrow.
Imaging things.
Well, there's more to it than that. There's a whole aesthetic side of mathematics. Mathematicians are very prone to use terms from aesthetics, like beautiful, proof, gorgeous, elegant. It is a very aesthetic experience, if you're really with it. If you're not really with it, it's sheer torture.
But you're just saying, you just said that there were a lot of little rules to learn and stuff. And before, I thought you said you went into math because you had a poor memory.
Yeah, well, you don't have to memorize the rules. A lot of it is just a question of efficiency. I mean, I could add two fractions without learning those rules just by trial and error. You know, I could futz around and play with thirds and fourths and fifths and sixths, and eventually I'd probably find two equal fractions that had the same denominator. If I want to speed the process up, then I can memorize a couple of rules. And the more rules I memorize, the more efficient I get as a calculator. But that's just sheer efficiency. You could do without the rules, to some extent, anyway.
Remembering too, is how useful is that, to know that?
To know fractions?
Yeah.
That's
where do you use it?
Kind of unresolved question, especially because of the impact of computers and calculators. We're revising some of our instruction that's taught by the computer now, because traditionally you used log tables, you spent a lot of time doing calculations by hand. De facto, people don't do it anymore, and especially when you're teaching adults. It's different when you're dealing with children. But when you're teaching adults, why in the world teach them long division? They're not going to do it. They're going to pull out the old $10 calculator. If you don't have one, go buy one. I mean, it's idiotic to do arithmetic by hand anymore. So there are going to be a lot of changes, I think, at least in teaching adults.
That's what I try to do. I try to relate teaching math to mm-hmm. something that's practical and useful.
Mm-hmm.
A child can see that, they're more apt to learn it. They're just doing it for the heck of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's another thing I have to learn? Yeah.
Well, I use it all the time, saying carpentry.
Right, okay.
There are lots of manual skills where you do need to, especially when you haven't moved to the metric system, where you've got to use a lot of awkward fractions. I mean, the book says I'm supposed to make this pipe 3/8 long, and it's got to fit into a 5/16 hole or something.
In chemistry, or weighing it, measures and weights.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's useful in that area still.
But don't you think adults accept the answers of the calculator because they have already memorized something back down there, and the kids haven't done it yet? You say it isn't
mm-hmm.
useful because you have to basically know those facts
mm-hmm.
to accept.
Yeah, there's a lot of debate going on about
it. I find myself doing that. What? That's impossible. Then I go back and say, the calculator was right.
There's a lot of debate going on as to what extent you should allow children to substitute the calculator for manual operations.
That's
and
why I call it threat.
I have mixed feelings about it. I'm certainly glad I know the manual way of doing things. I hate to be so reliant on technology that I couldn't do something. You don't always have a calculator with you. Your battery goes dead.
Yeah, that's
any number of things go wrong.
The battery goes dead during the test. You're
right. There you are in the grocery store and the battery goes dead. Well, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't get a battery instantly. So I think I've come down on the side of teaching children manual operations, but not spending as much time on it as we used to, because de facto they're not going to do it. Probably more kids than adults have hand calculators now because they're smarter than we are. They realize it's a waste of time to try to cope with this complicated world doing all these operations in your head or with a pencil. So in my math classes, for instance, I encourage all math students always to bring a calculator to class and to a test. so they won't waste time.
Actually, you have to know the basic principle to use the calculator. Mm-hmm. It's just that you're not following through with all the details.
You have to know some basic principles. You have to have a sense of numbers. For instance, if you had never done a multiplication by hand, you do make mistakes punching in numbers. If you can do it by hand, you have a sense of how big the answer ought to be. And if it comes out 80 million, you've multiplied 3 times 8 or something. You know, your finger has slipped, obviously. Same thing with computers. You got to keep an eye on it. I'll tell you what, I think in terms of hours, why don't we break at this point? Because the next thing I want to do is an exercise, and that'll take 15 or 20 minutes.